This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Welcome back to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan on BBS Radio. If you're listening live, you're on BBS Radio right now. So if you're listening at the archives, then The People Speak is at bbsradio.com/ The People Speak. And if you'd like to call in for a comment or question for Brian or myself, the number is 888-429-5471, and that's toll-free. In case I forgot to mention it, I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Tonight we have a very special guest, my friend and comrade, Brian Becker. I'm going to give Brian a little bit of an introduction. He has a really long bio that's at BBS Radio, The People Speak. Brian is the executive director of the ANSWER Coalition, which has chapters in 25 cities in the United States. The ANSWER Coalition was founded immediately after the September 11, 2001 attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C. ANSWER was one of the primary organizations that mobilized millions of Americans who protested month after month in the lead up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March of 2003 and in opposition to the continuing U.S. occupation of Iraq. Brian is the author and co-author of numerous books on U.S. foreign policy. The latest one is Imperialism in the 21st Century. Brian's articles appear regularly on liberationnews.org website, which is a news and an analysis site of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, PSL. Becker is a founder of the PSL and a member of its Central Committee. Brian is currently the show host of a daily one-hour radio show podcast called Loud and Clear for Radio Sputnik. The show is broadcast live. Oh, I'm sorry. The show is broadcast 5 days a week on radio stations' websites and is also available as an iTunes podcast. Brian Becker is an analyst and journalist on U.S. DPRK relations. That's the Democratic People's Republic of Korea relations. He has traveled to DPRK multiple times between 1989 and 2013. In 2014 and 2015, he was a featured speaker on U.S. DPRK relations at luncheons hosted by the Tokyo Press Club in Tokyo, Japan. And part of his expertise on Korea is why I've invited him on the show today. So, Brian Becker, welcome to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here.
Well, the reason that I asked you on is because, first of all, you're just very knowledgeable about so many things that are happening in the world and in the United States today. But I was on your show. I've been on your show, Loud and Clear, several times, and it's always good to be on such an anti-imperialist show that has a great analysis of U.S. foreign policy. But yesterday, Anne Wright and I, and Anne Wright, for people who are listening, is a retired 29-year colonel with the U.S. Army Reserves. Plus, she worked in the State Department for 16 years, and she resigned when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. So Anne and I were on your show yesterday talking about Syria and U.S. foreign policy, and I thought it was really good, and I thought it was something that we could not rehash because we're going to talk about more about Korea tonight. but something I think that a lot of people need to hear.
Right, right. Yeah, it was a wonderful show. We covered so many topics. And as you know, and as I think our listeners know, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, the pace of developments with the Trump administration's very aggressive, militarist-oriented foreign policy, the pace has been, I would say, nothing short of breathtaking.
Right.
When you see what's happened with the shooting 59 cruise missiles into Syria at the moment that he's having dessert with the Chinese president when he was visiting Florida, the fact that the United States could then drop this MOAB bomb, the 21,000-pound bomb on Afghanistan, just as a demonstration of its, you know, willingness to use unprecedented levels of violence,
right,
gratuitously. And then you have the Korea crisis, where it appeared that, you know, over the weekend, the U.S. was poised to carry out or initiate or be part of a new war in the Korean Peninsula that would, of course, become a regional and, I would say, probably global conflict. So our show that you and Ann Wright were on, and all of us who are looking at world politics, can't help but notice that this is like not just a normally dangerous time. This is an acutely dangerous time.
Well, absolutely. And I don't want you to talk for too long, because I don't want you to answer all my questions before I even ask them. But the thing that I think was very striking when we spoke yesterday is after Trump, or after the U.S., dropped the mother of all bombs, or MOAB, what's it really stand for?
It's a bomb blast. MOAB is something like, in other words, I can't remember the exact name, because we all call it the mother of all bombs,
right,
which
something,
of course, is
ordnance air blast or something like that.
Massive ordnance air blast bomb. It's MOABB, actually. Massive ordnance air blast bomb.
Right. And of course, the U.S. military always has cute little names for things, and so it's been nicknamed the mother of all bombs, which we talked on your show. To me, calling something like that a mother is just another way to force this stereotypical false patriotism about, you know, mom and apple pie and Chevrolet, and that, You know, most mothers I know would not all women, but, nor all mothers would be adverse to using something so bad. But the thing about this dropping of the huge bomb on Afghanistan last week was that Trump appeared not to really know anything about it. And he actually said something about he's given the military this authority. Can you explain that a little bit more to the listeners, and talk about how dangerous that is? It seems like an overt military coup. We know the military has been in charge of foreign policy for a long time, but this seems like it's now not even pretending to not be in charge.
Right. I think what we have with the Trump administration is a coalition government. There are the right-wing billionaire oligarchs like Wilbur Ross or Betsy DeVos and the Goldman Sachs gang. That's one wing. And then you have the military, and you see General James Mad Dog Mattis as the Secretary of Defense. We have McMaster, H.R. McMaster, General McMaster, the National Security Advisor, the key White House aide for foreign policy. And General John Kelly, Department of Homeland Security. There's the generals, and then there's the lunatic wing of the Trump administration, which I think includes Trump.
Right.
And of course, Trump is his own person. He's an extreme narcissist. He actually, I don't think, has any strategic thinking or ideological position. Bannon, of course, who seems to have been pushed out as a, you know, semi-fascist force within the administration, and also a lunatic. But what's noteworthy is that Trump actually has announced that, unlike the Obama administration, which he characterized as weak, that Trump will make America strong again by allowing the military commanders in the field, not just in the Pentagon, but in the field, to have a sort of power and authority to carry out military actions without restraint. Now that's a signal to the Pentagon that they can do whatever it is that they want to do. Obama and of course George W. Bush and all the previous administrations have had a lot of generals in the cabinet and a lot of generals with a lot of influence. But I believe, as you're suggesting, Cindy, that this has taken it to a new level. Obama at least imposed restraint on the Pentagon. There had to be consultation. They did not have a blank check to initiate war, say, in Iraq or in Syria or against Korea. Right now, Donald Trump has said, hey, guys, you have my authority. You have a blank check. You can go for it. And he's made it clear that he's going to do that. So you might be right. He might not have even known about the fact that the Pentagon was going to take this 21,000-pound bomb, and it's so big they had to push it out of the back of a cargo plane and let it float down with a parachute before it detonated, killing all things within the radius of 1 mile. Trump might have just learned about it afterwards and cavalierly then said, wow, that was beautiful, as he always says about all military actions. Right. Of course, the mainstream media says the same. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's a military government, but I don't think it's a coup, because a coup would sort of suggest that the Pentagon had to struggle to seize power from the civilian government,
right,
where you have the civilian government, in this case, surrendering civilian authority. And just one last point, it's not just Trump, because as you know, and as I know, as everyone who's went to school in America knows, only the Congress has the authority to declare war. And even though they've ceded that since World War II, they have required executive branch positions to come and get authorization for things that are war but are called something else, like military or police actions. The Congress didn't give authorization, nor did they actually whimper very much about the fact that that Trump has given the Pentagon a blank check to bomb whoever the heck they want to bomb.
Well, and just it's really amazing. You talk about, you know, that the Pentagon seems to, well, the military has gotten a blank check for these things, and that Congress has abdicated its role as being a check and balance to this military power. I haven't seen any commentary from the Democrats on the MOAB. Perhaps you have. But I know after the 59 cruise missiles that Trump shot into Syria, first of all, it appears that Hillary Clinton ordered him to do it. 4 hours before it happened, she was saying that she thought that the U.S. should take out all of Assad's airfields. And people like Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, and Schumer, the Senate minority leader, actually supported what he did in Syria, you know, with this talking point that, yes, Assad needs to be taken out. So comment on there's like absolutely no opposition to anything Trump's doing. And as a fact, in fact, now Trump is being seen as presidential and as a strong leader by a lot of politicians and pundits in the media.
Well, as you said on my show, in order to be presidential, apparently you have to commit war crimes.
Right.
Which, of course, the bombing of Syria is a war crime because the U.S. is technically at peace with Syria. The U.N. Charter makes it clear that member states can only attack other member states in the case of imminent self-defense. None of that was happening. So, yeah, I think what's happened is Donald Trump has dipped his hands in blood, and his Democratic Party critics have become either mute or they have actually gone into the mode of saluting Trump. I think it's extremely noteworthy that the Washington Post, which was highly critical of Obama because Obama wasn't enough of a war hawk, mm-hmm, because he at first didn't want to bomb Libya. I don't know if we all remember, but Robert Gates, who was then his Secretary of Defense, said Libya is not part of our strategic interests. in the region. That was in March 2011. And Obama sort of was not going forward. And the Washington Post said the passive president and condemned Obama. And the next day, the very next day, Obama, under pressure from the so-called liberal establishment, gave his green light to Hillary Clinton's war in Libya. And we know what happened since. Now you have the Washington Post. If you look at the Washington Post today, they are rapturous about Donald Trump's new orientation towards Syria and towards North Korea. So this is what we have. The Democrats support Trump as long as he acts like a crazed militarist. The Washington Post and the New York Times, who are fierce critics of Trump for many, many issues, are now supporting him. And Trump actually, even though he's whatever, not a strategic thinker, he's wise enough to know that this is the formula to completely defang any bourgeois sort of ruling class opposition to his administration as long as he stays in perpetual war mode. And I think that's what Trump's going to do, even for his own narrow interests, not like the interests of empire or anything else. He just knows this is the formula. So, you know, I would say to our listeners, Cindy Sheehan, if you want to be part of resistance against Trump, don't be part of the fake resistance. Don't be part of the Democratic Party-led resistance. It's an imperialist resistance. And as soon as Trump starts to act as a bold-faced imperialist, they're actually making common cause with him. We have to break from that kind of phony resistance to Trump and build grassroots resistance.
Well, like we spoke about yesterday, the latest women's march, I think it was in support of Syria, I mean, support of the Syrian people, or Syrian women, I'm sorry, that seemed to only diverge from Trump in that they were demanding the U.S. allow more refugees. But it seemed like it was, if it was in support of Syrian women, it certainly was not in opposition to what the U.S. was doing, only in opposition to what Assad is allegedly doing.
Exactly. You have the organization, that the Women's March organization that was calling actions on Syria, as far as I know, was not condemning the criminal missile strikes against a sovereign country, Syria.
Not at all.
And you know, you look at organizations like Move On. They're all there. Asking us to send money to them to support the resistance. But as soon as Trump embraces a policy of extreme imperialism, they say nothing. In other words, we have to have a resistance to Trump that isn't simply about the domestic social issues, as important as they are. It can't simply be about the defense of the Muslim community, defense of women, defense of immigrant rights, defense of the environment, and at the same time say, but guess what? We're going to close our eyes or shut our mouths when it comes to Trump's completely imperialist foreign policy. If we do that, we're going to be an irrelevant movement.
Right. Well, what they really are, what the subtext of that is we can't criticize Trump's imperialism because the Democrats are just as bad or worse as Trump is on that issue. And they could maybe find some differences in the environment and other social issues, but criticizing Trump for imperialism is criticizing, you know, the Democrats for the exactly the same thing, which they have spent the last 10 years not doing, since before Obama was elected. They've spent these liberal organizations have really bent over backwards not to have U.S. foreign policy or imperialism or, you know, even mildly being anti-war in any of their calls or any of their actions.
Indeed. I mean, when you think back about the unmistakably dynamic support that Bernie Sanders got against the Democratic Party establishment, you know, he had no money when he started. He had no possible path to the nomination. It seemed completely hopeless. And yet millions of people came out. Sanders said he's a socialist. However he defines it, you know, I'm a socialist too. I would define it differently. But that's not the point. For a mainstream politician, so to speak, and I think Sanders is more or less mainstream, to come out and say, I'm a socialist and I'm ranting against the Wall Street banks and I want free education, which should be free free healthcare. And you have millions of people go, you know, to support him, and millions of 90% of the young people who voted were voting for Sanders. But the day after Sanders was vanquished on day one of the Democratic convention last July, the Democratic convention moved not to the left, it didn't move in the direction of the Sanders supporters, it moved to the right. And the Republican convention, the Democratic convention sounded like the old Ronald Reagan conventions, USA, USA, USA. And then when WikiLeaks revealed that they had actually stolen the election from Sanders, they blamed Russia without proof. And so, and now we've had for almost, I don't know, 9 months now, this relentless attack as if Russia is taking over the world. Russia's taking over America. Russia made Donald Trump a thing. Russia threw the election. That's why Hillary Clinton, I guess, never visited Wisconsin, which she lost by 22,000 votes. I guess the Russians stopped her from going. I mean, like, everything was about the Russians. And I think that's also infected parts of the liberal movement and milieu, where you hear a lot of this echoing, which is completely ridiculous. It's another element where establishment politicians demonize foreign powers, not because they're necessarily demons. And you don't have to support Russia or support Putin to just realize that this is another demonization campaign, and it's really preparing the population for more confrontation with Russia, which is, of course, good for the military-industrial complex.
Well, earlier you said that Trump's escalating militarily against especially Syria, Yemen, we can't forget Yemen, Afghanistan and North Korea has defanged some of the liberal criticism, and it kind of just like takes a rug out of this that Trump is in alignment with Russia. It just that's not a claim that can be made anymore when he directly confronts Russia in Syria.
Yeah, and maybe the Russians had a somewhat utopian hope for Trump because they were afraid of Hillary Clinton. I mean, they really were. The Obama administration under Clinton and then again under Kerry has pushed the confrontation, especially in Ukraine. Again, American people are not getting the right story about Ukraine, but they pushed it to such a level that I think the Russians really feared a growing possibility of clashes and regional confrontation. Russia does not want to engage in an arms race. They only spend like $50 billion a year. That's too much. But $50 billion a year on military compared to the United States, which spends, you know, more than 10 times that amount. The Russians then thought, well, maybe Trump says he wants to improve relations with Russia. Why not have good relations with Russia? So to Russia's ears, that sounded better.
Right.
I told the people who were on my show, and of course I'm on Radio Sputnik, I said, I'm not optimistic at all because politicians come and go. What doesn't leave Washington and what doesn't leave America is the domination of Wall Street and of the military-industrial complex. And the hostility towards Russia is not because Russia is so bad or so aggressive or taking over the world. It's really because they needed an enemy, and they needed to push Russia back because Russia and China, and to some extent the BRICS alliance, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, was emerging as a counter hegemonic force within world politics. These were big countries, strong militaries, pretty big economies. If they banded together, they could be, you know, a counterweight to U.S. unipolar domination over everyone. And the U.S. wants to weaken Russia, wants to weaken China. And, of course, they've already carried out a coup d'etat in Brazil against Dilma. So,
right.
You know, I think that's where the hostility towards Russia comes from.
Well, absolutely. And it's already a deep-seated we've been conditioned to first hate the USSR, and then when that collapsed, where did that enemy go, you know? So Russia and the Russian Federation are already just like almost a ready-made enemy to keep the war machine going and to keep this like demented U.S. foreign adventurism going. There's they always have to lie about somebody or, fear monger. And we're going to talk about fear mongering around North Korea. We're going to go on a break in a few minutes when we come back from the break. But Russia is a ready-made enemy for not the empire, not the people in charge of the empire, but for the people who live here.
Yeah, I can remember as a 16-year-old when I was organizing against the Vietnam War in 1969, people, reactionaries and pro-war people, they come up and yell, "Go back to Russia." And I was like, wow, what? I mean, I wasn't a socialist then, and I wasn't a supporter of the Soviet Union then. I never had been to Russia, certainly wasn't born there. So, but you're right. It's now part of the DNA, because the unofficial religion of America after 1945 became anti-communism, and communism was synonymous with the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union, the biggest part of it was Russia. So, yeah, so the populations had, 70 years of training in, hate and fear Russians. So it kind of works.
It was just astounding, though. Like you said, all this demonization of Russia. I think it was on your show when I said that I really thought that the Democratic Party should change their local chapters into chapters of the John Birch Society, all of this Russophobia and red baiting that really is not even relevant for today, but that's certainly what they were engaging in.
Indeed, indeed. And I think the United States thought Russia would be on its knees forever after the overthrow of the Soviet government in 1991. But Russia's the biggest country in the world from the point of view of landmass. It has 5,000 nuclear weapons. It's a major economy. It's both an Asia, a Pacific power, and a European power. There's no way that Russia wouldn't eventually independently assert its own national interest. And frankly, Russia and China are not part of the imperialist colonizing club like Britain, France, and the West European powers, along with the United States. So they're kind of outliers. They're outsiders, and they don't want to be just junior partners to the United States. And they're afraid of the United States because, as we can see in the last 25 years, when the Warsaw Pact collapsed, that those were the Soviet-aligned military arrangement based in Warsaw, Poland. NATO promised, we won't expand east. We won't take advantage. We won't make those countries a staging ground for aggression against you, as Hitler did in 1940. And they violated their promises to Russia, and they're still violating them.
Right. Well, Brian, when we come back, we're going to take a really short break. But when we come back, I'd like to get into a topic that's very concerning, and that's U.S. Escalation of provocation against North Korea. So stay tuned. You've been listening to The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan, and our guest is Brian Becker. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Come, you masters of war.
Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan. I've been a peace activist since 2004 when my son Casey was killed in Iraq. I've learned since then that achieving peace means more than just being anti-war. It encompasses being pro-environment and pro-equality for all people of all genders, religion, and ethnicities. Please join me at cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com with many other people who believe in working for a more peaceful and humane future.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back to the People Speak Radio. I am on BBS Radio. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. We've been speaking with the National Director of ANSWER, and you know, many he's involved. He's got his fingers in many, many pies. Busy Brian Becker. But Brian, in your bio, it says that you've been to North Korea or the DP. RK many times. What's been your experience there?
Well, it's been very interesting because I've had the opportunity to go to North Korea in 1989, and then I went again a couple times in the early 2000s, and then I went again in 2013. And so Korea has gone through many stages. In 1989, the Soviet Union still existed as an entity. DPRK, North Korea, was doing quite well economically. By third world standards, it was relatively affluent. The entire country was, when I traveled from the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, to all the way to the northern part, the northernmost part of the country. Corn was growing everywhere, wheat, maize, rice. There was livestock. And then the North Korea had, along with Cuba and the smaller socialist countries, a calamitous, disastrous impact of the collapse of the socialist bloc countries, which were their aid and trade partners.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the U.S. was able to tighten the screws with economic sanctions. And North Korea went through a terrible period, just as Cuba did in the 1990s. There was hunger. There was famine. Now, Korea is sort of back on its feet, just as Cuba is. In 2013, there was a lot of robust economic activity. There's traffic was bustling. Pyongyang, for those who have seen pictures, is a beautiful modern city that was built from scratch after U.S. pilots completely devastated every part of North Korea. There wasn't one structure taller than one story standing even by 1951 during the Korean War. And the main complaint of U.S. pilots was that there was nothing left to bomb, but the U.S. carpet bombed the country for another two straight years after that. So North Korea has gone through many different ups and downs. Right now, I think there's a feeling that the advance of nuclear weapons, and I want to get into how and why North Korea developed nuclear weapons, but North Korea feels that their ability to have nuclear weapons as a deterrent to U.S. aggression against them, and again, the U.S. leveled the country completely in 1950, 51, 52, has allowed them to divert big parts of their budget away from military spending and towards economic growth. So that's very evident as you go around the country. For people who have never been to North Korea, the Korea Peace Tours, which I'm also helping to organize, is sending a delegation in early August. If people want to go, you can go to koreapeacetours.org and learn about it, or send me an email at brian@answercoalition.org. But we're going to send a delegation because we want people to go to North Korea and see it, because the only images you get in the media is this is a country led by a madman, or as the Washington Post said tonight, it's a complete prison camp. I mean, which is amazing, right? Especially if you go there. You have to see it for yourself. It doesn't mean you're going to be in love with North Korea, but it's going to shatter all of the stereotypes and caricatured images of it.
Same thing that happened to me when I went to Cuba in 2007, I think, the beginning of 2007. After, 50 years of the demonization of Cuba and Castro, what I saw there was certainly not what I had been conditioned to find when I got there, that's for sure. So earlier you said something about Trump was having dinner, and they had dessert, was beautiful chocolate cake, right?
Right.
With Chinese President Xi Jinping. And the significance of this, the dropping or firing 59 Hellfire missiles into Syria. And then I think it was the day after, the mother of all bombs, you found evidence that China is worried about that. Can you, and you in fact wrote an article about it. Can you, and so your article is, China sounds the alarm, Trump prepares for war against Korea. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think the Chinese president was stunned by the decision of the Pentagon and the Trump administration to actually fire 59 cruise missiles without providing evidence or going to the UN with evidence that would authorize the use of military force. Again, the issue was, did the Syrian government use chemical weapons? The Syrian government said no. The Russians said there may have been the bombing by a Syrian plane of a rebel-held warehouse, an al-Qaeda warehouse that had toxins in it. The Syrian government is now saying this, the rebels themselves did this as a provocation. Anyway, there was no evidence, and no effort to have the UN authorize the use of military force. So for Trump to do this when he's hosting Xi Jinping on day one of the visit to Mar-a-Lago by the Chinese entourage, including the head of state, and then they're having dessert, Trump is recounting this on Fox News. He said, oh, we had such beautiful chocolate cake and it was delicious. And he goes into great detail about about that chocolate cake. And then he says, and then I told the president, we fired 59 missiles into Iraq. I mean, when he was talking to Fox, he couldn't remember what country he had bombed.
Right.
He said, we 59 missiles into Iraq, and they were beautiful. They landed perfectly. They all hit their mark. And the Chinese president didn't say anything. He remained silent. Now, if you're China and you know anything about international diplomacy, which, of course, Xi Jinping is an expert at, you think, well, Trump is just rubbing his face in it, because at that same time, he's telling Xi Jinping, you take care of the North Korea problem, or we will, meaning we are prepared to do in North Korea what we just did in Syria. And, of course, that's on China's border. So there's no question that Trump and the Pentagon were sending a message to China. This is what we're prepared to do. Act like madmen. And the Chinese media, including the Global Times, which is not an official newspaper of the Chinese Communist Party, the ruling party, but it's generally understood to reflect the views of the Chinese Communist Party, had a very, very alarmist editorial where they said, they warned the North Koreans, we understand you're trying to act tough to protect yourself, but don't make any mistakes. The Trump administration is filled with belligerence. The U.S. is sending aircraft carrier, Trump called it an armada, to North Korea. Don't make any mistakes, meaning don't carry out what was anticipated to be another missile test or nuclear test on Saturday, April 15th, which is the 105th anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea. So, I think really part of what's going on is the United States, and you can see this in the media too, the United States is putting so much pressure on North Korea and on China that they're hoping to break the historic alliance between China and the DPRK. And if they could get a wedge between those two countries, and if some elements in the Chinese leadership say, we can't afford a confrontation, let's get rid of North Korea, let it go, as Gorbachev sort of let go of Eastern Europe, right. that would give them some peace. I don't think the Chinese will do that, and I think it would be a terrible, terrible mistake, because I think the real goal of the Trump administration is to carry out regime change and to unify the Korean Peninsula under the complete domination of the Pentagon and the CIA, which would be nothing short of a major disaster for China, given the fact that the United States is putting into Korea, even now, advanced missile defense shields like THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, which is not, they say it's against North Korea, but it's really against China. It's really an attempt to get military supremacy in outer space over China and Russia. And the Chinese military know this to be the case. Just one last thing. Not only do China and North Korea share a border, so does Russia, by the way, a smaller border, but that both powers share a border with North Korea. But when the United States, under Douglas MacArthur, tried to eviscerate North Korea and reunify the peninsula at that time under Pentagon control, and they stormed forward, the Chinese sent 1 million volunteers to fight back. Mm-hmm. 180,000 Chinese people died in that battle. And they defeated the U.S. They drove the U.S. out of North Korea. That's why they're back under the 38th parallel. Even Mao Zedong's son died in that battle. I mean, this is a big part of the Chinese sort of collective memory that the United States wants to take over Korea. And doing so means a direct and perceptible threat to China. By the way, at the very end of the Korean War, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Joint Chiefs of Staff authorized the full use of American nuclear bombs against all of North Korea and China unless they finally signed the armistice agreement on July 27, 1953, which China and the DPRK then did. But the U.S. was at that moment planning to carry out the nuclear annihilation of both countries. So again, that's understood by China. It's understood by North Korea.
Well, then talk about, you wanted to talk about how North Korea developed nuclear weapons. But I want to say I haven't been to North Korea, but I've been to South Korea. And, of course, the Pentagon and the CIA and the U.S. government is, you know, in charge of South Korea. And so they just want that to spread north and to be in charge of all, be like we're dominating all of this region. And, of course, she says not about Korea, it's about China. But did you want to talk about the development of North Korea's development of a nuclear weapon?
Yes, I do. And I think it's extremely important for our audience to understand that, because demonization misinforms Americans, especially, who are getting our news from the mainstream media. So you think of North Korea as provocative and aggressive. First of all, North Korea has offered both President Obama and President Trump that they would suspend any further nuclear weapons tests or missile tests in exchange for the U.S. canceling the war exercises that take place every year that simulate the destruction of North Korea, the decapitation of its leadership, and the takeover of the country by the United States and South Korea. Now, the last year's exercises were called Decapitation. That was the code name, Decapitation. Mm-hmm. And the North Koreans said, look, cancel these games and we'll suspend the war, we'll suspend missile tests. If they're so terribly provocative, that would have given the U.S. a good reason to stop, you know, say, okay, we'll cancel them for 1 year. But immediately Obama said no. They made the same offer to Trump in January of this year. Trump immediately and his cabinet said no. Okay, so that's just for our audience. North Korea has been willing to suspend its nuclear weapons tests in exchange for the end of war games that simulate its destruction. The way North Korea decided to get nuclear weapons was this. And I'm not going to give the whole story, but I'll give a shortened version because of time. In 1999, in 2000, in fact, there was a liberal South Korean president, Kim Dae-jung. He had what was called the Sunshine Policy. He wanted to normalize relations with North Korea, reduce tensions, and begin the process of the peaceful reunification of Korea. The Clinton administration, or at least some people in it, were convinced that that would be a good idea. And Madeleine Albright was dispatched to North Korea, and she met with Kim Jong-il. And she attended those ceremonies in those giant stadiums where, you know, there's 100,000 people with flashcards. And it looked like the Clinton administration was about to normalize relations with North Korea, and they were willing to talk about a peace treaty and the easing of economic sanctions. That was 2000. But Clinton did not complete that process. He went out in January 20th, 2001. George W. Bush became president. In early March, George W. Bush had Kim Dae-jung come to the White House, where Bush personally ridiculed him, where Bush treated him rudely. And if you know Korean culture, that's a big deal.
Right.
And he personally called Kim Jong-il names. He said he was a pygmy or something like that. In other words, characterizing the North Koreans in the most racist way. And then it was clear that the U.S. was not going to go along any further with normalization. And a few months later, George W. Bush said, there's an axis of evil in America. It's Iraq, it's Iran, and it's North Korea, and began the preparation for the invasion of Iraq. And it was then that North Korea left the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It has a right to leave it if you feel threatened by not having nuclear weapons. It went through the formal process and said, under these circumstances, we are leaving it. They kicked out weapons inspectors, and they began the process openly of building nuclear weapons. That's why North Korea has a nuclear weapons program today. It's not because they wanted it. It's because George W. Bush sabotaged the normalization and went back to a war footing against this small country.
Well, do you think a lot of people were concerned over the weekend that, like you said, on the 15th, their holiday, that there was going to be another missile test, and there was, and then there wasn't. Do you think that China putting pressure, or North Korea, as an expert on this, as North Korea looked at how, like you called Trump a lunatic, and I agree. Do you think that stopped them from doing a test? They still had their parades, and showed, their military hardware and things like that. So do you think that made North Korea back down a little bit?
There's two parts to this story which are extremely interesting. And, it just shows how much none of us know until after the fact. But they had the military parade on April 15th, and they showed they showed intercontinental ballistic missile capabilities. In other words, that they're making advances in their missile technology. But they did carry out a test. They carried out a ballistic missile test. It was not a long-range test. It was an intermediate-range test. On Sunday, and the test failed, and all of the recent tests, after having numerous successes, have failed. And there's a widespread sort of thinking at this point that the U.S. is carrying out cyber war against North Korea, and able to, through cyber warfare techniques, sabotage their missile technology. So the test failed right away. So I don't think the North Koreans actually backed down, because if they had been preparing for a nuclear test, they wouldn't have been able to just switch over 24 hours and say, okay, now we're going to have an ICBM test instead.
Right.
So I don't think they did that. Yeah. But here's the other thing, Cindy, which is every day brings some new shocking piece of news. The U.S. Armada that Trump said was going to North Korea, the thing that I wrote about, the thing that we talked about, the USS Carl Vinson aircraft carrier sent to North Korea. Guess what? It was never sent to North Korea. That whole thing was a hoax. That whole thing was fake news.
Wow.
In fact, the U.S. was sending the USS Carl Vinson not towards North Korea, but south. And the story came out when a reporter who follows defense industry stuff was paying careful attention to the photos on Monday, and started to do the investigation. So right now, as we're speaking, if you look at the front page of the New York Times, the story that the New York Times and all the other media have been running for the last week turns out to be fake news.
Wow.
And they said, well, they're not apologizing for not doing it, because they're just repeating what Trump said. Trump said, we're sending an armada. Mm-hmm. He just fired those missiles while the Chinese president was here. In other words, but the media in America just embraced the story, went with it. And then, of course, you have the Washington Post congratulating Trump for sending an armada that, he didn't send. I mean, that's how ludicrous this whole thing is. But it just shows that what Trump was really doing was playing mind games, psychological war, I don't think really with the Koreans, because they actually probably knew the exact location of the USS Carl Vinson in the so-called armada. They knew it wasn't coming towards them. Trump is playing, and the Pentagon is playing, psychological war games with the American people, preparing us for a confrontation with North Korea. The last week we've been told North Korea is going to carry out a nuclear weapons test. Well, they didn't. The U.S. is preparing to stop them through by sending an armada. Well, that actually never happened.
Wow.
The whole thing is a psychological, well, again, I want to curse, double mind, you know what, in order to prepare the American public for a sort of an acceptance that North Korea is bad, North Korea is promoting hate, U.S. is going to the rescue. We narrowly averted a crisis, but another one's coming soon enough because Donald Trump, he's strong. He gets things done, blah, blah, blah.
Well, you see so many postings and people are actually afraid of this nuclear war with North Korea, which I don't understand how North Korea could, you know, bomb us, but without, again, the analysis that it's United States that's completely provoking it and completely the instigator, as always. We just have like a few minutes left, Brian, and I want you to give your websites and things like that. But something that came up in our interview yesterday, too, is you've been doing this for a long time. You lead one of the most powerful anti-empire coalitions still operating in the United States today. How can you talked about demonization? How can we, or should we say, we oppose U.S. interventionism on, you know, for example, Syria, without immediately having to say, but Assad is a bad guy? Can we do that? Should we do that?
Well, I think, you know, when I before the Iraq war, I was going on MSNBC a lot, Fox News, CNN, all the mainstream media, and they all demanded that I denounce Saddam Hussein at the same moment that I was, you know, saying the U.S. shouldn't go to war. But, you know, there's a downside to that. A lot of liberals did that but then the next question is if Saddam Hussein and Assad are such monsters and you're not for war, what are you for?
Right.
Are you for nothing? If they're really these great demons and they must be stopped and America has a moral duty, American imperialism, of course, which has no morality, but has a moral duty to do something that we recognize is evil incarnate. Well, then people start to say, well, yeah, it shouldn't be war. Let's have economic sanctions. Well, what are economic sanctions? They're not an alternative to war. Economic sanctions are a way of killing babies and their grandparents, the most vulnerable people in society, by depriving them of food and medicine and the things human beings need to live. In other words, it's slow motion war. So I think that there needs to be an independent political assessment of the Assad government, just like the Iraqi government. I'm not a Baathist. I'm a revolutionary socialist. I wasn't for Saddam Hussein's political positions. I didn't have rose-colored glasses on, but I never agreed to participate. And as a matter of principle, when I was being asked to demonize the demon by the imperialists, who I consider to be the greatest demon of all, I just wouldn't participate. So I say the Syrian people and they alone can determine the future of the Syrian government. They alone can deal with the issue of Assad. U.S. imperialism and French imperialism and British imperialism, which tore up that region. They didn't give a damn about democratic rights when they were the foreign colonial powers enslaving those Arab people and using chemical weapons against them. They have no right, absolutely no right, to tell us that we should hate Saddam Hussein or Assad or Muammar Gaddafi or whoever they've decided must be overthrown. So I say no, reject demonization completely. That doesn't mean you have to embrace anybody. But again, I do think it's important to realize in the case of the Assad government, religious minorities have been protected. Women in this secular society have rights. In other words, there's a minimum wage. There are unions, even if they're not very independent unions. There was a legal communist party that can function. In other words, by Middle East standards, it wasn't the most regressive society by any means. Certainly the United States supports the most regressive regime. So let's not listen to American imperialism to tell us who to hate.
Right,
because they
exactly.
only do it. They tell us that so that we prepare the American people to tolerate any new criminal acts by a government that speaks in our name.
And the only reason we know they're bad guys is because the bourgeois media and imperialists have told us they're bad guys. So, Brian, what's the best website that our listeners can get more information?
Well, of course, the answercoalition.org, Answer Coalition is all one word, is our national website. As you said, we have chapters in 25 cities. People can join Answer in their city if there's one near you. We also at SputnikNews.com, you can hear my daily show loud and clear. It's loud and with an ampersand and clear with Brian Becker. And you can sign up on our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. And there's a new website, Cindy, and I know you and I are both part of this. It's called congressofresistance.org, congressofresistance.org. Check that website out. It's a new project. We're building a Congress of resistors, anti-imperialist resistors who are also fighting on domestic issues against Trump and against the Congress, because following the Democratic Party is following a fake resistance. So that's going to happen in Washington, D.C., the People's Congress of Resistance at Howard University, September 16th, 17th. That's an exciting new project. And that website, again, congressofresistance.org.
Thank you so much, Brian, for being on the People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. And hope to see you soon.
Great. My pleasure. Thanks so
much. And talk soon. Bye-bye.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.